I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Christopher Auchter joins me again. The acclaimed filmmaker has a new film, a full-length feature that will debut this week at the Vancouver International Film Festival. In The Stand, Christopher, with archival film and audio, takes the audience back to the fall of 1985 when a small group of Haida blockaded a dirt road on Lyell Island to demand that clear-cut logging stop, as it's been destroying salmon habitat and ravaging the old-growth forests. There's a lot of pressure exerted by the provincial and federal governments, as well as private logging interests, as the RCMP is called in to keep the peace and at times enforce various court orders. We see the court of public opinion form against the Haida, most vocally in the form of talk show host Jack Webster, who talks about the issue regularly on his highly rated BCTV morning program. I'll ask Christopher about all the archival material he was able to draw upon. There's radio interviews, as well as high-quality film shot from the perspective of the Haida, as well as a private logging firm contracted to work the forest. We see what it's like for the RCMP, too, as the various points of view are featured throughout almost moment to moment. We see their conversations with the elders who take up the blockade, who also have to arrest them later on. We see Guja on the front line and how he communicates with others over a radio. Miles Richardson is featured in the film through his appearances with Webster and their vigorous debates, as is the then NDP MP Sven Robinson, also a lawyer, who's on the front line. As a complex legal process plays out, the obtaining and enforcing of injunctions and the sort, we see what it's like on the front lines, and how with such dignity and grace, what compels the Haida to take a stand. There's a great character in the film used as a sort of narrator that I'll ask Chris about, Mouse Woman, voiced by Dolores Churchill. She adds some levity but also poignancy as we see throughout the film, as well as narrative information that provides further context to the events. It's a powerful film and one that tells necessary history considering what this critical moment provided as an inflection point for the future of land claims and Indigenous sovereignty. Christopher Auchter has appeared on the program twice to talk about his previous short films, 2017's The Mountains of Skanna and 2019's Now is the Time. Christopher Auchter wrote and directed, as well as animated, The Stand, which is produced in association with Knowledge Network and the National Film Board of Canada. The film screens at the Vancouver International Film Festival this Thursday, the 3rd of October at 8:45 p.m. at SFU Woodward's, and Saturday, the 5th of October at the International Village at 3:15. Chris will be at both screenings. We taped this interview about 11 days ago. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Christopher Auchter. Mr. Auchter, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. I was telling you just before we started how much I enjoyed this film. I was quite fascinated by it, quite interested, but quite moved by it as well. Now, we're both too young to have remembered what happened in 1985. What were you told, say, growing up about what happened that fall of 1985 on Lyell Island? I mean, oral histories, were they passed down to you over the years?
Yeah, I mean, it was something I knew had happened. Like, I knew both my uncle, Michael Nicol Yakalanis, and my auntie Shelley Hageman. I knew both key figures in my life. I knew they both took part in Lyell Island and fought down there for the Haida. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it just kind of went that far. I didn't know more than that. Biggest thing I knew is probably that my auntie Shelley met her husband Clayton Gladstone, and they had my and they had John Charles, who is my cousin, a close cousin. It's almost like a brother. So, you know, if that event didn't happen, I wouldn't have this great cousin John. But, you know, like, so I didn't know much of what had actually happened down there, and that's kind of what made me come to want to tell this story. Is after Now is the Time, I finished that now. That a short documentary film. I was like, okay, what's going to be my next film project? And I think how I came to wanting to tell this story is that the entrance to it was almost like a way for me to try to honor all that time and love that my Auntie Shelley and my Uncle Mike gave me growing up. And I was like, you know, they were really, this was a pivotal moment. Like, this might be a way to kind of give back a little bit and say thank you. And also, at the same time, really try to understand what happened down there and opened up that whole world, because I had to then figure out what happened before that, the Lyell Island 1985, what, you know, the events that led up to it. Were there other things that were similar, where there was kind of these Haida uprisings and stuff, and then what happened after the blockade ended on Lyell Island. So it was just an enormous kind of research and dive into the world, trying to figure out, you know, what happened down there.
And it's a this film itself is a remarkable piece, because there are people who are younger than us who almost take it for granted, what's happened after all of this has happened. You know what I mean? Like, because of what happened in 1985 on Lyell Island and what that's meant for Tidal and for sovereignty and the sort, not knowing what happened and what led to all that. I think it's important for not just, you know, for future generations, certainly, right?
Yes, for sure. I was talking to Arnie Bellis, who was down there on Lyell Island, one of the leaders, and he was telling me, like, you know, this is a good time for myself to be doing this film, because he said even our younger generation of Haida, they don't know what happened down there. And there's this funding body that came from Lyell Island. It's called Gwai Trust, and it funds a whole bunch of programs on the islands of Haida Gwai. Both Haida and non-Haida communities can access this fund, and it came from Lyell Island. And Arnie was saying, like, the young ones just think that Gwai Trust has always been there. And so he said now there'll be an opportunity for them to understand, oh, that's what it took, you know, for something like Gwai Trust to have, you know, been a part of their lives today and providing, you know, a service to the community today. So that was just one of those kind of moments where, you know, like, I heard it from Arnie that, you know, this, it's important for, because otherwise people will forget this story, I think. Yeah.
So what was happening, I guess, at the beginning, near the beginning of your film, why this blockade rises and why it happens, is because there was logging being done by, I guess it was Western Forest Products, but it was done by a subcontractor, by this fellow Frank Bebin. And there was some talk in the early part of your film about how they weren't managing the resources well enough, that there were landslides, and so the Haida decide that they have to stop this, right?
Yeah.
It's a complex legal process, and we see how it unfolds, and you know, it unfolds in isolation, literally, because you know, this is all far away. In terms of what was happening on the front line, the rest of the country was watching this, weren't they?
Yeah. Like, when I was talking to my uncle, like, especially before I had started doing any editing with my editor, Sarah Hadar, like, asking him stories and stuff, and just, trying to get that understanding of what was going on. And he said, like, this was kind of a worldwide event. Like, it went even outside of Canada. It was picked up in the United States and in across the seas in Europe, and it was international news. And my uncle kind of made this nice way to, he said that the Haidas standing there in the rain in their red and black woolen blankets, facing off against the RCMP was and the loggers was irresistible. He said it just, people couldn't turn it off from the TV. Like, they needed to tune in and see what was going on, because this hadn't happened before in Canada. So like a blockade like this hadn't happened. It was the element of surprise, and the RCMP, the courts, the government, they didn't know how to respond. They didn't have something else that had happened that's similar to kind of go look to and go, okay, well, that's how we handled it there. You know, we're going to do it
sure,
here.
Yeah.
This was all new, and so it was breaking ground. And every time the Haida were in the court, in the courtroom, something new was happening, like unprecedented. It hadn't happened before. And so, yeah, it was, they were breaking new ground, all over the place. And it was that element of surprise that really caught everyone off guard and made this quite successful for the Haida.
It's also a critical moment, isn't it, Christopher, where, because in the film, as people will see, there's a lot of waiting around. This is nearly 40 years ago. There's no internet, and even the phone isn't really used. A lot of them are using radios and the sort. It could have become violent, right? I mean, I think that was the fear on a lot of people's parts, right?
Yeah, definitely. It could have, and that was one of the things. Like when they first went down there to the Haida went down there to Lyle Island to block the road and tell Frank Bevin and his crew, like, there's no more logging here because the Haida designated this a protected area, and they brought as many of the young and tough Haida youth as they could, the ones that could maybe hold their ground, mm-hmm. if it got physical, and you know, because they didn't know what the reaction was going to be from that, and in terms of the you know, the phones and you know, they're talking on CV radios, and everybody could listen in on that, right?
Yeah,
like
exactly.
They're not secured lines, so the Haida resorted to talking Haida in the Haida language as much as they could, so that anybody listening in, RCMP or the loggers, wouldn't be able to understand what they're saying. So there's almost like they're using the Haida like a code and stuff like that. It was really fascinating to look at and at the footage and know that was their strategy to but I mean, there's a moment in the film when the elders first arrive, and I made sure to include it. You could just hear Ethel. She's one of the elders, and she says, she's just sitting down, and she's like, well, if one of the loggers push me, I'll fall down and stuff like that. So that little comment, you know, it's in their mind, like, we don't know how this is going to unfold. We're here, but, you know, like, an elder thinking that she might get, you know, like, physically pushed around, like, that's incredible.
The movie is marvelously paced in terms of, you know, how you tell this story, and that's your gift in terms of the editing. This archival footage that you use in the film, it's both film and audio. They're just tremendous to watch. The quality is so good, especially of the film. How much of all of this did you have to work with? I mean, this must have been several hours, but probably several days of film that was shot, right?
Yes. I mean, in total, when I added it all up together in terms of the audio and the live action footage that I amassed, it was over 100 hours. I sat and listened and watched through all of it and recorded it all in like a spreadsheets, because I'm like, well, if I don't record this now while I'm watching, in terms of taking down notes in terms of what's on each of these tapes and audio, then, you know, I'm going to have to go back and redo it all again. I have this almost like a novel size kind of spreadsheet with, you know, with notes on what's on each tape and stuff like that. But I needed to go through all that to really go, okay, what do I have to work with here? And also to try, again, that research and stuff and trying to understand what led up to this and how that can help me to better understand and tell this story, you know, when we're in the events that are actually going to be used in the film. So I was trying to hint out and tease out that some of those information that, you know, maybe it could have been used and stuff like that. So I was just constantly looking and searching, and and a large, like a great deal, maybe 60% of the film footage and stuff that you see is from Susan Underwood and Donna, who both went up to Haida Gwaii. They were filmmakers from here in the Lower Mainland, and they mm-hmm. heard what was going on, and they flew up to Haida Gwaii, and they made a good impression on the Haidas, and were allowed to stay with them in their Haida camp in Lyell Island, and they recorded like so many of the events, so you have all these intimate moments and these kind of behind, you know, the supposed behind the scenes, you know, like yeah. So seeing all that footage and stuff like that, and massing, you know, other stuff from CBC, BCTV, the BC Archives, because the secret that, or the one thing that I was really interested quite early on is I really wanted to try to tell this story almost like it's happening in real time, or like yeah. it's like a, you know, somewhat like a scripted drama in terms of how that unfolds, so that I thought that would be compelling for the audience to kind of be able to take in the story that way. And any interviews that I used in terms of the person who's being interviewed cannot know what's going to be happening the next day. Mm-hmm. So there's no retrospective or anything like, oh, we were doing this and this because of this. No, they're explaining it as they see it in that moment. And that might not be the most, you know, concise of an answer that's given to the reporter, you know, like sure. there's some beautiful moments like with Guja, a huge figure yeah. in the Haida community, you know, great leader, great speaker, you know, but he had these moments where the reporter was asking him a question and he really had to think about it. And there was just so much honesty in that moment that I just needed to keep it because I think that's so, that makes someone like myself who's like, you know, constantly trying to learn but always feeling like, you know, somewhat like I'm, you know, maybe fumbling or trying to search for the answer. And it just made it's so impactful for me because it's like even the ones that were there, you know, they're trying to figure it out for themselves too. And there's just a beauty in telling the story where they don't know what's happening tomorrow either. Like, yeah. Are the Haida going to back down? Are they going to stand their ground and stuff like that? So, you know, so that was the type of story I wanted to tell and why I didn't use narration or modern day interviews, because yeah. I didn't want the sands of time to kind of cloud kind of what they were seeing. I wanted it to be as true so that the people that were there were almost like they're telling their own story because they're there and we could see it. Yeah.
Yeah, and then you add this character, Mouse Woman, in the film, the way that character is animated as well looks like it's from the 80s. It doesn't look like an animation it's obviously created, in the present, but it looks like it's something from then, and it adds so much to the film itself, because we get clarity and perspective. We also get something whimsical, and I think by the end of the movie, people will find something profound and moving about this character itself. In terms of what Mouse Woman represents for you, and what do you think it adds to the film?
Yeah. Well, in terms of what she represents is, so Mouse Woman's a supernatural being, and she's supernatural beings are, it's a cornerstone of our culture and things like that. Like they are pretty much all of our stories are related to supernatural beings somehow, but they also, a supernatural being is they're all over the land. Like there's not a point or a river or a mountain or area that doesn't have a supernatural being connected to it. So it's a way for the Haida people to also connect to the land, and also a way that kind of keeps us in check. So it's like, oh, we can't just go in there and start, you know, throwing ourselves around and, you know, let's take down that tree or let's, you know, let's overfish or be disrespectful because there's a supernatural being that's kind of watching it. And so our stories are filled with ways that the Haida have gotten themselves into trouble with supernatural being, and often most women is the one that will kind of come in and help and try to be that kind of go-between the supernatural being and the Haida. But most women's also spunky, too. She's small, but she'll stand up to a lot bigger of a supernatural being, like a lot stronger of one, and just kind of tell that supernatural being off if she feels they're being unreasonable. So yeah. There's also that nice kind of connection between the Haida taking on Canada. Like Haida, in world standards, like we're a small group of people, and we're taking on this large country, Canada, and to get to have our voices heard and have them listen, that they can't keep doing this to the land that sustained our culture for over 14,000 years. It just can't go on anymore. So there's that, and so most women is also a symbol of what the Haida we're fighting for down there. That's our culture in most women. And in turn, she's also the one symbolizing the supernatural beings, which I believe we're giving the Haida people down there on Lyell Island strength to be able to stand on that road and face down the RCMP when they're coming up to them, because they're putting their freedom on the line, or the loggers as well.
Yeah.
And to have the strength to try to do it without violence. Without yelling or without, you know, pushing and using strength, like an incredible amount of steel in terms of holding their emotions in check, and so those are all kind of things that most women represents in the film, and it's almost like after her it's almost like she was calling on the Haida to come. And, you know, say enough is enough in terms of the opening scene in the film. But, she represents a lot.
And then when we see Mouse Woman on screen, you know, we often see her with these info cards, as you call them. And they truly fill in the context because there's no narration. And as you said a moment ago, you tell the story almost in real time. That it gives the viewer, you know, this marvelous, you know, background or context, even a look ahead as to you know, what'll happen, or what happened right after, if you will. The there's another I would say a supporting character in the film that we see throughout, and that's Jack Webster, and clips of him on his BC TV show every morning. You know, his argument is often colorful and voluble when he says it's just about the jobs. Well, we later find out that he and a lot of the so-called cabinet ministers had an interest in the continuing of the logging. In terms of how you use him and footage of his rhetoric, it's fascinating to see because in 2024, it looks odd and almost quaint, but that's how a lot of people felt back then, right? People that were in opposition to the Haida.
Yeah.
He was giving them voice, if you will, right?
Exactly, yeah. Like, Webster really became a way for me to touch on a larger conversation in terms of how the rest of the province and maybe even a little bit of the country was feeling, but definitely the province of British Columbia, because, you know, we'd have there's moments where callers, you know, could call in and speak to how they're feeling about what Miles is saying and Webster's saying. And also Webster with these, just making these outright, like, just these crazy comments and stuff like that, like really not holding anything back and willing to ask and phrase a comment anyway. He pleases. It just was a way to, because, you know, those I'm sure other people were thinking those things that he was saying, and he was just coming out and saying it. But it offered this chance for this debate to happen between Webster and Miles and Gosnell, and it was a way to touch on the bigger context, the bigger thoughts and ideas, you know, like what do the Haida want, and like what are they fighting down there for, and and even being able to talk to David Suzuki, and he gives another, you know, or Tom McMillan, like it just gave a way to kind of it helped bring the story along, but in a way that I again didn't need modern day interviews. It just Webster added a ton to the film, I think it brought this electric kind of message or information that I could give to the audience in a compelling way, in a way that I think they're gonna sit at the edge of their seat and go, oh, what are they gonna say to each other next, and you know, like or what's gonna happen next? I don't know. It was just when I was looking the first time I was screening, you know, those episodes of Webster and he's talking about Lyle Island, like it really became apparent quickly that I'm gonna need to include this in the film, and he's going to be a character in the film. And thank goodness that he did spend so much time talking about Lyle Island and broadcasting it, because that kept the issue and in terms of what the Haida were fighting for really front and center, and which is part of what the Haida wanted. They wanted the media attention. It is fascinating because there were times when the Haida, in terms of one of their courts battles, were starting to go to Prince Rupert instead of Vancouver, and they noticed that the media wasn't picking up the stories as much. So they found a way to ask the judge if they could have the next hearing in Vancouver, like the sentencing or something like that in Vancouver. And they said, oh, you know, it'll save the government money and stuff like that. All the lawyers, you don't have to come up to Prince Rupert. We'll go down to Vancouver. Can we change the sentencing to Vancouver? And the judge agreed. And when they went to Vancouver, my uncle said it was like the Beatles were coming to town. There were so many people at the airport waiting for them. They were back on track. The media was covering it again. So it was very, very smart the way that I think intelligent the way the Haidas were handling the whole situation.
Yeah, it's remarkable to watch because, again, this is in a context where it's 40 years ago. And a lot of the things we take for granted today in terms of how to get media attention, they had to come up with it themselves, didn't they? You mentioned Tom McMillan a moment ago, and this reminds me in the film you spent some time about what the federal government was thinking of doing, and they have a remarkable role in terms of, you know, trying to mediate this between the Haida and the provincial government, the social credit government of the time, and there is talk in the film about, you know, turning this to cease the logging and turn it into a national park, but there was a lot of opposition to that too, which your film reminded me of. I mean, on both sides, the idea of a national park was not something that they were keen on, right?
Yes, definitely. No, and even Miles says in there, like, we never ever asked for a national park. And I was talking to, again, Arnie was telling me that there's some Haidas that fought on Lyle Island that to this day are not happy that the Haida settled for having a park down there. So I know it's still contentious today. It's protected, so we all have to be happy about that. It's still contentious, I think, and obviously, the logging community, like Frank Bedman saying, they were definitely wishing for a different outcome.
The interactions between the elders and the RCMP, I found that quite moving, also surprising. Did that surprise you as well?
Oh, big time. Yeah, like I was like, where in today, in our, you know, modern history, have you seen the police interacting in that way? Like, it just seemed the communication lines were so open, like talking and talking. And I talked to Constable Harry Wallace. He's kind of the main RCMP officer that we see most of the time, mm-hmm. and in the stand. And I talked to him. It was like it was really hard to find his contact, but we found it kind of like with some detective work. And I called him and I talked to him, and he said that he thinks he got off on a really good footing right from the get go. They came in by boat, and immediately they went and landed in the Haida camp area, mm-hmm. and they were just making lunch and stuff. They had halibut soup, and he went and he got some halibut soup, and he had the soup, and then he liked it so much he asked for seconds, and he said it just seemed like they're really happy that he liked the soup so much. And so then there's just this talk of the food kind of really helping to in that first meeting between him and the Haida. So it kind of helped open that line of communication right away. And then, yeah, and then you had these moments. I was watching footage at the, it was the RCMP and the Haida sitting down at Hattie Camp over coffee, and they're just discussing what each other are hearing over the radio and stuff. Mm. RCMP saying, well, you guys seem to know before us what's going on, so maybe you tell us what's going on and stuff like that. So it was incredible. And, yeah, you know, I kind of hope that's kind of seen and taken in today and kind of going, we could learn from this in terms of really how to police these types of big events, and rather than militarized police. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. You mentioned food, and in the film, there is a supper that happens. I don't want to give too much away because I found it quite moving, and I found it quite delicious actually watching what they were all eating. I was going to ask about the footage. So you mentioned these two filmmakers who had shot a lot of this film. They also shot Bebin away from everything that was happening, and they got to talk to him privately, right?
Well, that was some of that, like the stuff with Bebin, that was from, I think, CBC. From CBC, yeah. But okay. But there were other moments where it's like, how the heck did they get this footage? Like, you know, like in terms of being right in the logging camp, you know, before we ever even meet the Haida in the film, we're put right in the middle of Frank Bevan logging camp, and kind of we get a chance to see what he's thinking, what his right-hand man is thinking, the loggers, like, and then we get to travel with them to meet the Haida for the first time. Just like, how did they get this? So, it was just amazing the access that Susan and Donna had.
Yeah, and then you have those intimate moments in the camp where you have Guja and Sven Robinson is in the film, and they're strategizing, if you will, or Sven's talking about some of the legal ramifications of some of the charges. You know, this is just great stuff that I think if it were today, I mean, they'd broadcast this stuff live, and how it would all turn out would probably be different than what happened. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Are you working on something else now, Christopher?
Well, right now I'm working on I have a couple of scripts. Kind of, I'm at that stage right now. I'm working on a couple of scripts. One's for a feature animated film, and one's like a more of a short animated film. So, and then possibly early stages of another documentary, but that's, I'm not sure yet. So it's kind of things there. I'm at that stage again where I'm like, okay, what's going to be next? But I doing one of the hardest things I've done is in terms of writing a feature length script. That's like, holy smokes, that's a lot of lot of work and a lot of effort. Yeah, trying to keep my mind kind of, to contain a whole, you know, a story like the one I'm working on. But And sorry, I just wanted to just mention quickly about the rehearsal night. Yeah, that really captivated me as well. Like in terms of being able to go in there and kind of see like how the Haidas were preparing for that next day on the line and stuff like that, and meeting the police office for the first time. I thought that was I don't know. I really hope the audience finds that interesting as well, because I certainly did.
Yeah, and if you wrote this as a movie, for example. Mm-hmm. And you had characters like the marvelous elders and the way they talked to one another and the dignity that they obviously exuded in front of the police and the loggers. You put in a character like Webster, a character like Miles Richardson and Guja. Hollywood would probably tell you this never happened. you couldn't make up characters like this, and the way that you capture them in this movie is just a marvelous. You put this all together. I mean, I could see how this would all have played out in real time if you were watching the news every day or listening to the radio every day. But to have it all in this one piece, in this one narrative, it's a terrific achievement. Just a tremendous film. Chris,
thank you.
Chris, I'm a big fan, and I can't wait for the next thing. But until then, I'll urge people to see this at VIFF. Thanks for your time today. I so appreciate it.
Thank you. I really appreciate your time. And, yeah, and thank you so much for all your comments about the film. And, yeah, beautiful. Thank you.
The Stand will be screening at the Vancouver International Film Festival this Thursday, the 3rd of October. That's at 8:45 p.m. at SFU Woodward's, as well as Saturday, the 5th of October, at International Village, 3:15 p.m. is that screening. Visit viff.org for tickets and information. Christopher will be at both screenings, incidentally. The film is called The Stand. It's writer, director, and animator Christopher Ochter joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plutum.